Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Linda, and today I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram. Today is Wednesday, January 19th, 2022. Hospital, expect long waits at ER. Midland Memorial cites COVID case surge, staffing shortages for backlog, by Stuart Doreen. If a person goes to the Midland Memorial Hospital emergency room, it may be a while before they are admitted to the hospital, if that is required. Midland health officials said Tuesday morning that 21 patients were waiting for a hospital bed because of the increased activity. That activity includes an increased number of COVID patients. As of Tuesday morning, that number was 103, 47.4% of the inpatients. Midland health officials said Tuesday that there are 217 total patients in-house. That meant 80.3% of the available beds were filled. Midland health officials told the Reporter Telegram that some of those beds available were in specific units: neonatal intensive care unit, NICU, pediatrics, and labor and delivery, so that limits options. They also said the current lack of staffing also factors how many people can be moved from the emergency room at this time. On Tuesday morning, Midland Health Chief Operating Officer Stephen Bowerman said there was one patient that had been waiting in the ER for an inpatient room for 64 hours. That's over 2 days, Bowerman said. That's not ideal, certainly. Bowerman said Midland Memorial Hospital has remained busy with COVID patients, topping 100 for the first time since September. He also said there were 196 ER visits on Monday, a number he said was down from recent peaks, around 250. He credited some of that slowdown to Midlanders not using the ER for testing. One result of the current numbers crunch is MMH will not be accepting patients from outside the county. Bowerman said MMH had been able to take transfers recently, including COVID patients. He said on Tuesday that 19% of the 103 COVID patients were from outside the county, including Las Vegas, Harlingen, El Paso, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. So whenever we're full like we are now, our emergency room, through a system that we have throughout the Permian Basin, will let smaller hospitals that refer to us know that we are full and we're unable to take any transfers at that time. We've been in that position most of the last 2 years, it feels like. Certainly when we have opportunity, if we have a couple of critical care beds that open up, we'll communicate on that tool that we have availability and that we'll take patients from the surrounding areas. If we don't have beds available, then we'll communicate with those hospitals that we can't take their patients at that time. That's why you're seeing patients in our hospital from Weatherford and from El Paso. They're experiencing those same things. Bowerman said Midland Memorial has 24 critical care unit beds. We have our supervisor and nursing operations team that are evaluating who's waiting in the emergency room. That's another thing you have to take into consideration. You have 21 patients waiting for a bed. If you free up a couple of beds upstairs, you know they're coming from the ER, but they evaluate that on an hourly basis. And whenever we have capabilities, we'll update that site and let those surrounding hospitals know that we're ready to take patients if they have any. School board debates calendar. Intersession remains controversial topic as no decision made yet, by Stuart Doreen. There is no board consensus on the school calendar for 2022-23. Three board members stated they would oppose or at least would be hesitant to do away with a calendar that does not have intersession days. There was even a point during the meeting Tuesday when board member Rick Davis asked Superintendent Angelica Ramsey about her preference. She told those in attendance that A-rated districts with some of the challenges Midland ISD is facing have two-week intersessions to help students struggling catch up. She added there isn't data currently available to know whether a change now would be effective. Then she stated her preference is for 2 weeks of intercession. The school board discussed two drafts of calendars from the District Educational Improvement Committee. Both options didn't have the 2 weeks of intercessions. One did offer a week in the spring. Those representing the DEIC told the board there really wasn't support for the intercession weeks or other aspects of the current calendar, such as teachers having to return prior to the beginning of August. A majority of people participating in a district survey favored a calendar which moved intercession days to Saturday instead of weeks in the fall and spring. Three board members, Davis, John Tristiti III, and Robert Marquez, also said they wanted to see data for this year, the first that Midland ISD has used the intercession format in the school calendar. Davis said a change to the intercession calendar was made to improve academic outcomes. Marquez added, "This district is in dire need. I don't think changing paths would be the right thing to do." Katie Joyner, as expected, was the most vocal about moving from the current calendar. She didn't support the intercession calendar last winter. She also called the DEIC options a compromise that still provides intercession time for students and would allow a more robust funding of Saturday learning already taking place on some campuses. She also pointed to the results of the survey from the community. Ramsey, at one point in the conversation, said those community members wanting a calendar like Midland ISD previously used are not being truthful about wanting change. "It can't be both," Ramsey said at one point. "Be honest if you want change or not." Before the calendar conversation, Ramsey did tell DEIC members making the presentation that theirs was not an easy task, as no one was going to be happy with everything. During the presentation, they told board members about teachers' thoughts about intercession. One comment stated there were teachers that took the intercession seriously and others who just showed a lot of movies. Most of all, they provided the view of the calendar from the perspective of the teacher. DEIC members will meet again next week with the input from the board, more conversation, and a decision about the 2022-23 calendar could take place during the board's meeting in February.
Hello, this is Cindy, continuing to read from the MRT for Wednesday. Zone Change Worries Residents Living Near Holiday Hill Road, by Mella McEwen. A request for a zone change drew concern and questions from neighbors living near the acreage at Pimlico Drive and Holiday Hill Road. The lone public hearing on Tuesday's Planning and Zoning Commission meeting was over a request by Chukwuma Mbagwu for a zone change from AE, Agricultural Estate District, to CE, Country Estate District, on 4.97 acres, on the north side of Pimlico Drive and east of Holiday Hill Road. The request was made as the lot is being replatted into 4 1-acre lots. The minimum lot requirement in the AE is 2 acres, whereas rezoning the lot would allow it to meet the lot requirements of the CE. City staff noted that about 50% or more of the surrounding properties in the area are zoned AE, but are an acre or less per lot. Neighbors questioned where the property would be accessed, while others expressed concern that the preliminary plat showed access near the neighborhood pool area. City staff said that it appears access would be from Pimlico Drive, though a final plat of the property hasn't yet been received. Commissioners sought to assure neighbors that the zone change was only one step on the process. "Even if we okay the zone change, that doesn't mean we'd approve the plat," said Commissioner Chase Gardoff. Added Commissioner Zachary Deck, when questioned why there would be a zone change before the final plat has been received, "This is part of the process. Commissioners unanimously voted to approve the request." Juvenile dies in county fire. One juvenile is dead and 2 others were transported to a local hospital after a fire on Monday southwest of Midland. The county reported that its fire marshal's office responded at 5:30 p.m. to a structure fire in the 4100 block of South County Road 1226. County officials said one adult and two juveniles were transported to a local hospital with serious injuries. One of the juveniles died at the hospital. The second juvenile and adult were transported out of the area to another hospital. The cause of the fire is still under investigation at this time. No other details were released. DPS ups reward for cold case tips. The Texas Department of Public Safety has increased the reward money being offered in a 1977 West Texas cold case. DPS is offering up to $6,000 for information that leads to an arrest in the slaying of 73-year-old S.A. Champ Weaver. The Texas Crime Stoppers reward is increased with the hope that the higher reward money will generate additional tips, according to DPS. The higher reward amount will only be paid if the tip is submitted before the next case is featured, according to DPS. On January 4, 1977, Weaver's 1971 Monte Carlo was found running on the north shoulder of Highway 302, 4 miles west of Kermit. Weaver was robbed and shot multiple times. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Weaver, who had been elected the Precinct 4 constable for Winkler County, was last seen earlier in the evening at the lounge he owned, the Elbow Room. Weaver also owned a waterworks pumping station. The Texas Rangers are assisting the Winkler County Sheriff's Office with this investigation and are the primary investigative agency. Anyone with details regarding the homicide is asked to come forward with information. To be eligible for cash rewards, tipsters must provide information to authorities by calling the Crime Stoppers hotline at 1-800-252-TIPS-8477. All tips are anonymous. Individuals can also submit information through the Texas Rangers cold case website or by phoning to the missing persons hotline at 1-800-346-3243. Center delays art event until February 8th. The exhibition reception for award-winning artist Diane K. Brown has been postponed due to COVID. The new date for the event will be 6 p.m. February 8th at Sibley Nature Center. The exhibition showcases her largest collection of portraits to be shown one time. The Sibley Nature Center is open from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Grande Communications rebrands with name change by Mella McEwen. Cable, telephone, and internet provider Grande Communications has changed its name to Astound Broadband, powered by Grande. More than 38,000 Midland-Odessa households are eligible for Astound service. According to company officials, local customers will not need to take any action as the local team managed by local Grande managers will continue to provide customer service. There will be no change to customers' billing process at this time other than the name change. The move brings 5 regional brands, Grande, RCN, Wave, InTouch, and Digital West, under one name. This is an exciting time for our company with our new name, solidifying our commitment to astound our customers each and every day through our national fiber-rich network. Fast, reliable service, mission-critical connectivity, and award-winning customer service, said Jim Holanda, CEO of Astound Broadband, in a statement. Keeping ourselves grounded in our deep-rooted focus on customer service is at the core of what we do. We've been part of our local communities for years. Our dedicated teams will continue to serve the areas where they live and work. Throughout the coming weeks, Astound will systematically update the branding of all its properties and assets, ranging from vehicles and signs to websites, collateral, uniforms, and more. To emphasize strong continued regional service focus, each entity will retain sub-brands under the Astound umbrella, with Astound Broadband powered by RCN in the northeastern U.S., Astound Broadband powered by Grande in Texas, and Astound Broadband powered by Wave on the West Coast. Recently acquired systems Harris Broadband in Central Texas and WOWS, Illinois, Indiana, and Maryland markets will follow by mid-year. For business services, the combined companies will be unified as Astound Business Solutions. With 31,000 route miles of fiber across the country, the company will continue to fuel innovation and meet customer needs, including alternate fiber paths to protect against loss of data or workflow during an outage, essential for small and enterprise businesses.
Hello, this is Michael, reading the obituaries published in the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, January 19th. Barbara T. Elliott. Barbara T. Elliott, 79, of Midland, passed away January 13th. Visitation will be Thursday, January 20th at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel, 2508 North Big Spring Street, Midland, Texas, 79705. The family will also be available from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. to greet guests. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, January 21st at Grace Lutheran Church, 3000 West Golf Course Road, Midland, Texas. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park, located at 4616 North Big Spring Street, Midland, 79705. Barbara was born August 15, 1942, in Midland, to Alvin C. A.C. and Eldora Tynert. Barbara is survived by her children, Dwayne Elliott and wife Dana of Loudoun, Tennessee, Brad Elliott of Odessa, her sister Carolyn Hartsoge and husband Bill of Midland, granddaughters Jordan of Tallahassee, Florida, Ryan of Washington, D.C., Brittany of Manhattan, Kansas, and Alyssa of Odessa. Also, preceded in death by her mother and father, Eldora and A.C. Tynert, and brother Ray Tynert. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Grace Lutheran Church Building Fund. Funeral services under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Dovey Nichols. Dovey Nichols, 92, of Midland, passed away Friday, January 14th. Funeral service will be held Wednesday, January 19th at 3 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Rosewood Chapel in Big Spring. Private burial will be held at Mount Olive Cemetery. Dovey was born on May 27, 1929, in Noble, Oklahoma, to Gladys and Leroy Wallace. She attended Midland High School and married Claude Nichols, May 31, 1947, in Midland. Dovey is survived by her children, Claudia Chase and husband Tim, from Mansfield, Texas, son John Nichols and Autumn of Monahans, Texas, son Mark Nichols and wife Sherry of Midland, 9 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren, and 1 on the way. Dovey is preceded in death by her husband Claude and daughter LaDonna Adkins. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and American Cancer Society. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Glenn Ross Chandler. Glenn Ross Chandler, age 86, of Seminole, passed away January 16th in Ira Ann, Texas. Glenn was born in Ozona, Texas, on December 15th, 1935, to Clarence Allen Chandler and Lily Langford Chandler. He was preceded in death by his wife, Carlene, his parents, Clarence and Lily, his siblings, Clarence Chandler Jr., Jean Chandler, and Mary Ellen Kimball. He is survived by his four children, Carrie Carson and husband Charlie Don of Sheffield, Christina Lipke and husband David of Longmont, Colorado, Kevin Chandler and wife Tia of Crane, Texas, and Casey Jones and husband Lance of Andrews, Texas. He is also survived by his 10 grandchildren and 15 great-grandchildren. Graveside services will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, January 21st, at the Sheffield Cemetery in Sheffield, Texas. Services are under the direction of Schaefer Nichols Funeral Home in Crane. Samuel Sam Granado Ortiz. Samuel Sam Granado Ortiz, age 58, of Midland, passed away at his home on January 11th. Sam was born in Midland January 30th, 1963, to the late Tranquilino Ortiz and Ramona Granado Ortiz. Sam was very close to his nephews, Leroy Ortiz and Anthony Ortiz. He was preceded in death by his parents, his brothers, Humberto Ortiz, Eloy Ortiz, and Arturo Ortiz. A memorial service will be held Wednesday, January 19th at 2 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home is honored to serve the Ortiz family at this time. Susan Keller Yarborough. Susan Keller Yarborough, 67, of Midland, passed away at her home Monday, January 3rd. Susan was born July 16, 1954, in Salem, Illinois, to Wanda and Don Keller. She grew up in Midland, enjoying her childhood and teenage years, graduating from Robert E. Lee High School in 1972. After college, Susan began her career as a teacher in Van Horn, became residence hall director at Angelo State, worked in Midland for King Ranch Oil and Gas before returning to school for her paralegal degree and working in Dallas and Memphis. In 1999, Susan married the love of her life, James L. Jimmy Yarborough, and they shared 20 happy years together, residing in Midland. Susan loved to travel with Jimmy. They drove all over the United States and explored as far away as Antarctica and Alaska to see the wildlife. From an early age, Susan had a desire to help people, and while at Texas Tech University, joined service organization Beta Sigma Phi. She later served on the boards of Hillcrest and Bynum Schools and the Yarborough Foundation. Susan took up stitching as a hobby while in college and continued throughout her life. She was very active with her friends at Stitch in Time and could be found there most Saturday afternoons when in town. Her family and friends felt special when they received one of her needlepoint projects as a gift. Susan was preceded in death by her husband, Jimmy Yarborough, and her parents, Donald T. Keller and Wanda Hawkins Keller. She is survived by her stepchildren, Katrina Yarborough and Tamara Jones K. Yarborough, and grandchildren, Rowan, Faye, Penny, and Leo, sister, Nancy Keller Miller and husband, Joseph, brother, William N. Bill Keller and wife, Stephanie, niece, Sarah Miller Jones and husband, Travis, and their children, Fisher and Reagan, niece Rebecca L. Miller and nephew Brian L. Miller. The family would like to express their gratitude to Susan's longtime housekeeper, Sandra Cabello, Martha Ramirez, and all of her caregivers, Hospice of Midland, and Susan's many friends. In lieu of flowers, the family asks for donations to the Hillcrest School of Midland or the charity of one's choice. Celebration of Life will be held Saturday, January 22nd at 11 a.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Chapel. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Death notices for January 19th. Adela Vaquera Riojas. Adela Vaquera Riojas, 87, of Midland, passed away Sunday, January 16th. Funeral Mass is set for 2 p.m. Wednesday, January 19th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Arliss Doyle Maddox. Arliss Doyle Maddox, 89, of Midland, passed away Monday, January 17th. Graveside services will be 11 a.m. Saturday, January 22nd in Tucumcari Memorial Park at Tucumcari, New Mexico. Local arrangements under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory in Midland. Frank Joseph Holly. Frank Joseph Holly, 87, of Midland, passed away January 16th. A rosary service will begin at 6 p.m. on Thursday, January 20th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. A graveside service will be held at 3 p.m. Friday, January 21st at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Harvey Ramirez. Harvey Ramirez of Midland died January 16th, 2022 in Midland. No services are scheduled at this time. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland. Joseph Calvin Evans III. Joseph Calvin Evans III of Odessa died January 14th in Odessa. Graveside service will be held on January 18th at 10 a.m. at Graveside at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland. Glenn Waddleton. Glenn Waddleton of Winsboro died January 12th in Midland. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Arrangements entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland. Marcus Jerry Hawkins. Marcus Jerry Hawkins of Odessa died January 11th in Odessa. There are no services scheduled at this time. Arrangements entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland. Mary Atwater. Mary Atwater, 71, of Midland, passed away January 15th. The family will receive guests from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Friday, January 21st at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, January 22nd at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at npwelch.com. Mitzi Wirtz. Mitzi Wirtz of Odessa died January 8th in Midland. There are no services planned at this time. Arrangements entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland. Patsy Busey. Patsy Busey, 91, of Midland, passed away January 15th. Service is pending with Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland.
This is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, January 19th, 2022. Council Wants County Input on Game Rooms by Kim Smith. The Odessa City Council is still hoping to join forces with Ector County commissioners to help address the prolific of game rooms throughout the county and the corresponding problems some of them are causing local law enforcement. Back in October, the City Council made it clear they wanted to amend ordinances governing game rooms because some have prompted police calls due to strong issues, violent crimes, and illegal gambling. In the future, the city would like to restrict such establishments to light industrial or heavy industrial zones and restrict their hours of operation to 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 8 a.m. to midnight Friday through Saturday. They'd also like to make sure they are located at least 1,000 feet away from other gaming establishments, churches, schools, health care facilities, public buildings, or residential areas. In addition, the council would like to require future gaming establishments to provide the city with floor plans, and there have been discussions about requiring the businesses to be private clubs with restricted access. If the changes are ever adopted, the council said existing establishments would be grandfathered into the existing ordinance unless the establishment is sold or its license is revoked or expires. During a council meeting in October, City Attorney Natasha Brooks told the council that under state law, only counties can enforce a 1,000-foot rule, not cities. Since then, the city's legal team has researched the issue further and provided County Judge Debbie Hayes with that research. However, Mayor Javier Hovind said Tuesday the city has not heard back from the county on the matter. He's also been led to believe the individual commissioners may be completely unaware of the changes the city has been discussing. On Tuesday, the council instructed Brooks to send a letter to Hayes, County Attorney Lee McClendon, and all the county commissioners asking them for their input and giving them a February 15th deadline. If that deadline passes without the county's input, council members made it clear they would move forward with at least some of the ordinance changes, not acknowledging whatever they do will likely prompt lawsuits. Five new gaming rooms have popped up on 8th Street just since October, and more are in the works, Hovind said. Several community members have spoken up about their displeasure, Hovind said. The city is not trying to outlaw the businesses, but we're being overrun and it needs to stop, he said. Somebody has to take the first step, Hovind said. In other matters, Odessa Police Department Deputy Chief Matt Davidson and Corporal Ian Capitz pitched a 10-year, $7 million agreement with Axon, a Scottsdale, Arizona-based company that develops technology and weapons for law enforcement agencies and the military. Under the terms of the contract, the company would provide OPD with the latest technology possible, including tasers, body-worn cameras, helmet cameras, dash cams, and drones. The company would also provide training and records management and evidence management systems. Those systems would also improve the department's ability to share records and evidence with the courts. The men said the city could save $5 million over 10 years by entering the agreement rather than purchasing the items a la carte. Right now, the city has a contract with Exxon and four other companies, but under the proposal, the city would be able to combine all of them into one contract and have one yearly expense, Capitz said. Among the highlights of the contract, dispatchers and supervisors would be able to view all cameras live if necessary. If tasers are deployed and guns are drawn, an alert would be sent so backup officers could be dispatched immediately. SWAT officers' cameras could be mounted on their helmets instead of their bodies, preventing blocked views that are a safety hazard and improving transparency. The department would get enhanced license plates readers. Within a matter of months, the department's current license plate readers have gotten 206 hits, meaning they've alerted officers to stolen vehicles and those associated with Amber Alerts and missing persons. Exxon's data is kept in the cloud, therefore decreasing the burden on the city's IT department and allowing supervisors easier access for training purposes. The contract would increase the department's drone fleet from 1 to 4, which would allow the department to respond to more missing persons calls, fires, events, and SWAT calls. In addition, officers could do more fatal crash reconstructions, and the city could use them in its marketing efforts. The contract comes with product warranties, thus cutting down on replacement costs. Right now, each body camera costs $1,000 to replace, each taser $2,000, and each dash camera $6,000. Davidson and Capitz said some of the contract could be paid for with seized assets, but were hesitant to throw out any figures because it varies from year to year. However, they noted the contract would lock in the cost for the next 10 years, costs that are guaranteed to go up every year, and the department would be spending money on the equipment and software anyway. The council was also asked to consider signing a $356,797 contract with Onyx General Contractors to improve drainage, handicap access, and sidewalks at 10 intersections, including those at Pembroke Street and Bonham Avenue, Dixie Boulevard and Walnut Avenue, and Peabar Ranch Road and King Ranch. In addition, the city was asked to give an $82,900 contract to Crafro of Chandler for 5 years' worth of crack sealing compound. The compound is enough to cover 16 miles of roads. MCH COVID patients more than 100 by OA News. For the first time since the first week of September, Medical Center Hospital's COVID inpatients now number more than 100. Elective surgeries, which in previous surges have been suspended, remain on track at the hospital. Visitation screenings also remain in place at MCH and most hospitals. MCH, as of 8:30 a.m. Tuesday, reported 101 COVID patients in-house. MCH detailed Tuesday that the hospital is just short of maximum capacity and dealing with staff shortages due to COVID. Officials are asking community members to be careful and take precautions. They urge Odessans to get vaccinated and boosted and to get tested if ill. The World Health Organization on Tuesday reported a 20% surge in global cases, with almost 19 million new cases in the past week. The organization warned high levels of transmissions give the virus more opportunity to mutate and form new variants. Also on Tuesday, a free COVID at-home test program rolled out. To get the free test, visit specialusps.com. Chief says new crime report is more useful, by Kim Smith. The FBI has created a new annual crime report that provides a more in-depth look at crime in the United States, and it's one Odessa Police Chief Mike Gerke believes will be a much more useful tool than the old uniform crime report. The URC only collected data on 8 categories of crimes, but the National Incident-Based Reporting System collects data on 24 crime categories, breaking each one down into 52 specific crimes. NIBRS, NIBRS, is intended as an intel product. It breaks down the offenses a lot more specifically than UCR does, Gerke said. UCR has very few categories that you try to lump everything into using their rules, and NIBRS has far more categories that everything fits into a lot better. Having more specific numbers will help agencies create better strategies, Gerke said. You can now use those stats to say, hey, this is what we need to focus on, because when we see a category like larceny, that could be 900 different things. Just from those stats, you don't know if you need to focus on shoplifters or car burglaries, Gerke said. The FBI began requiring law enforcement agencies to report their stats using NIBRS beginning in January 2021. According to the NIBRS report released by OPD last week, homicides fell from 13 in 2020 to 9 in 2021, and auto thefts dropped to 371 from 467, Gerke said. Burglaries, which had jumped 25% from 469 in 2019 to 584 in 2020 due to criminals taking advantage of empty businesses during the COVID lockdown, dropped to 508 last year, Gerke said. In fact, crime appears to be down in general, but a direct comparison is difficult to make in many of the categories, simply because of the differences between the UCR and the NIBRS system, he said. For example, crimes counted as larcenies fell from 2,122 to 1,971, and aggravated assaults fell from 788 to 478. But again, that's one of those things that's not technically, probably, absolutely true, because the numbers just don't match up, Gerke said. It's the same thing with rape. It's down from 107 to 61. But again, those numbers don't match up correctly. They just don't count numbers the same. When you talk about UCR rapes, it's not just sexual assaults. It was molestations. It's all of those things lumped into one. Although pleased the numbers appear to be trending downward, Gerke said they're still too high. His department and residents have a lot of work to do, he said. There are some things I'd love for the community to do for us. We still see a lot of auto burglaries where the car doors are unlocked, where valuables are left in the car, Gerke said. We'd absolutely appreciate the citizens locking their cars at night and taking their valuables out, particularly guns. We still have a number of guns that get stolen in auto burglaries out of unlocked cars. In addition, people are still having their cars stolen with the keys inside, he said. On the positive side, Gerke said he is thankful for programs like Crime Stoppers and Neighborhood Watch. I think we all need to get back to that time where neighbors looked out for each other, Gerke said. If something suspicious is going on in the neighborhood, you call each other. You call the police. You come together to see what can be done to solve those issues. You knew your neighbors. I know we need to get back to that, where we all talk and we all know each other. It was just a better time, and I think we can get back to some of that. It's the department's mission to bring crime stats down and make Odessa safer, and to that end, Gerke said they are constantly looking for ways to accomplish that. For example, when violent crimes were up a few years ago, the decision was made to prosecute many of the offenders in federal court, where the cases moved along quicker. Also, we've kind of transitioned to intellect-led policing, which is simply policing by the data. We try to put officers where the crimes are occurring, and we keep up with those stats on a weekly basis. We look for those areas where crimes are occurring, and we gather intel to find those prolific offenders, Gerke said. I think we all know it's just a small number of citizens that cause the vast majority of our issues. We focus now on identifying those individuals and dealing with that problem. Technology is also being used more frequently, especially because the department has 35 to 40 empty positions right now, he said. Luckily, we've been able to, over the last few years, purchase some technology that has helped close that gap and be force multipliers, Gerke said. We've got a small camera network around town now that's helped with surveillance. We've got some little license plate readers around town now that have helped us find some bad guys' stolen cars like that. In addition, Gerke said they've created a bridge with Midland Police Department so officers can see OPD's records management system and OPD officers can see theirs. The OPD is also part of the National Integrated Ballistic Imaging Network, which allows the department to process shell casings so they can link shell casings to certain guns and certain shootings. Everything we're doing, we're sharing with our neighbors, with the Ector County Sheriff's Office, Midland County Sheriff's Office, and with the Midland Police Department, because we understand that crime is regional. Criminals just do not stay in one place, Gerke said. Big bucks boost Sparks' Senate bid. Midland Oilman gets heavy support from hometown, by Bob Campbell. Midlanders look dead serious about sending native son Kevin Sparks to the Texas Senate in Austin, having given most of the $297,060 that Sparks has reported collecting to the Texas Ethics Commission. Running against Amarillo's Jesse Quackenbush and Tim Reed and Stormy Bradley of Big Springs in March 1st Republican primary, Sparks is also enjoying his family's full-bore backing with $50,000 each from his father, Don, who ran unsuccessfully for the post in 2004, and his brother, Jeff, through the November 18th deadline. There's no Democrat in the race, so winning the Republican nomination appears to be victory in the November 8th general election, although a May 24th runoff will be held if no one gets at least a 50.01% of the March 1st vote. More money will be reported by the four Senate candidates and by Republican State Brooks Landgraf of Odessa and his opponent Casey Gary to meet the 5 p.m. Tuesday deadline for contributions accepted through December 31st, none of which have been posted by the TEC at mid-afternoon Tuesday. Quick hits. Free drive-through COVID-19 tests. The City of Odessa Incident Command is partnering with Curative to offer the COVID-19 PCR test drive-through from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at the corner of 2nd Street and Grant Avenue. Insurance information will be requested. If no insurance, test will be free. To book an appointment, visit curative.com. The City of Odessa is partnership with DOCS Docs Health has scheduled drive-through COVID-19 testing from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Sunday at the UTPB Community Sports Fields parking located at 191 and Loop 338. The entrance will be located on the 191 access road, 42nd Street, and exit will be on Loop 338. The site will have both PCR test and rapid test available. This will be the second COVID-19 testing site set up by the city with no out-of-pocket cost. No appointments needed, however, online registration is available. Testing is subject to daily availability of material. PCR test results are expected within 2 to 3 days in most cases, and rapid test results will be a 15 to 20 minute wait at the site, or you can receive your results via text message. ERCOT presentation and discussion. Brad Jones, ERCOT interim president and CEO, has scheduled an ERCOT presentation and discussion on the electrical grid and mapping infrastructure at 2 p.m. today at City of Odessa City Hall Council's Chambers, 5th floor, 411 West 8th Street. Town Halls. Ector County Judge candidate Dustin Fawcett has scheduled at 6 p.m. at the following dates and locations. Thursday at Odessa College Zant Community Room in Odessa. January 27th, MCM Grande Fun Dome. February 1st, Kellis Turner Community Center. February 3rd, Gardendale Community Center. February 8th, South Ector Community Center. Casino Night Fundraiser. Justice of the Peace Precinct 2 candidate Cynthia Marino has scheduled a casino night fundraiser from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Thursday at the Odessa Country Club, 1 Fairway Drive. Read to Felix. The Ector County Library Children's Department has scheduled Read to Felix at 4 p.m. Thursdays at 3rd Floor Auditorium at the Library, 321 West 5th Street. Felix is a therapy dog that loves to be read to. Asado Plate Fundraiser. The Hispanic Heritage of Odessa has scheduled an Asado Plate fundraiser from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Friday. Plates are $18 per plate and will include asado, rice, beans, and potato salad. Free delivery for two or more orders. Proceeds will help fund HHO reading programs, Senorita programs, Hispanic Excellence Awards, and Celebrando La Culture. To order, call 432-349-9840. Winter Shopping Expo. American Legion, Earl S. Bailey, Post 430, 2701 East 8th Street, has scheduled a Winter Shopping Expo from noon to 6 p.m. Saturday. More than 35 vendors will be available. Student Science Experiment Heading to International Space Station by OA News. The Innovation Office of Ector County ISD announced Tuesday that for the third time, ECISD students will send a science experiment to the International Space Station, ISS, through the Student Space Flight Experiments Project, SEP, Mission 16. SEP is an international competition that allows 5th through 12th grade students to design authentic experiments for microgravity environments. SEP mirrors how professional scientists work by having students' teams write research proposals that are evaluated by panels of experts, a news release said. The winning experiment proposal from ECISD is Swetha's Kesavan's proposal studying biofilm in microgravity. Her experiment will undergo further testing on Earth and a final flight safety review before launching to the ISS later this year. Kesavan, a senior at Permian High School, is working with her teacher, facilitator Gregorio Mercado, and two faculty from the University of Texas Permian Basin Biology Department, Paula Gutierrez and Joanna Hernandez, on this experiment, proposal, and research. For this year's Mission 16 competition, 23 communities from all over the United States, as well as Canada and Ukraine, submitted entries. The winning experiment from each SEP community will be ferried to the International Space Station, and experiment will be operated by the astronauts in a microgravity environment, the release said. Ground control experiments will be conducted by the students on Earth, and then the students will analyze the results from the two experiments. Participating students will also have the opportunity to present their research at SEP National Conference during the summer of 2022, planned to be held at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. An additional component of SEP is the Mission Patch competition. Students in all grade levels can participate in SEP by creating Mission Patch art. Two Mission Patches will fly to the ISS with the winning team's experiment and return to Earth certified as flown in space.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.